The Queen's Jewish Link presents the Jewish Living Podcast, the show that examines the many facets of Orthodox Jewish life. Here's your host, Izzo Zwirin.
Welcome back. I hope you all had a wonderful Yom Tov season, and now it's time to get back to all of our regular schedules, which includes the Jewish Living Podcast. This week I wanted to have a little fun, so I invited on someone who can talk all about one of my favorite topics in Judaism, our music.
Hi, I'm Binyamin Kinsberg. I'm a musician. I lead a band called the Breslov Bar Band, and I've also recently published a book of transcriptions of sheet music of Hasidic Nigunim, focused on the music of the mitzvah tans as performed in the courts of the Hasidic Rebbes.
Binyamin is a wealth of knowledge about Jewish music, and we are privileged to have him on to go through the history of Jewish music as well as its role today. Binyamin, thank you so much for joining me this week. I appreciate you coming on. I actually met you only a few weeks ago at a wedding, and a mutual friend of ours, who actually has been previously a guest on this show, Shimi Feintuch, recommended that you'd be actually a really good guest to have on. So I'm glad that you were able to find the time, and I was able to find the time to have you. So thank you so much and welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start off with some little bit of background about you. Can you tell us, I know in the introduction you gave us a little bit about what you're doing now, but talk about your background, how you got into music as a profession, and where that all started from.
Music just kind of happened, actually. As a kid, I was always fooling around and playing with different musical instruments, anything I could get my hands on. And at some point, I wanted to take music lessons. I wanted to learn how to play trumpet or drums when I was, I'm going to say, about seven. And my parents vetoed both of those instruments. But I was given a year of violin, not by choice. And at the same time that they gave me a year of violin, they gave my two sisters immediately underneath me piano lessons. So it was kind of funny because I was the one playing more piano than them, even though they were the ones studying it. And so eventually that turned into a year of piano lessons, which was not a good match. The teacher was not a good match for me. She was this very hardcore classical practice, 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 and you'll make it to Carnegie Hall and be a professional concert pianist. And I wanted to learn how to play something that I knew or recognized. And she was absolutely not willing to teach or indulge any of that. It was, you're going to play this minuet and then you're going to learn that classical piece and you're going to rehearse it a million times till it's perfect. And so I dropped that and I wound up in an out-of-town yeshiva high school starting in 10th grade, where there was absolutely nothing to do during free time unless you played basketball. If you didn't play basketball, so there was absolutely nothing to do. And so I wound up focusing on music, even though it was officially against the yeshiva rules to play an instrument most of the time.
Oh, wow.
But I bought some piano courses and I spent time on my free time playing through the book. I knew enough from the music lessons to read sheet music, at least on a very basic level. And I spent time focused on teaching myself how to play that instrument. And when I went, we had a yeshiva band for a time, played on Purim, and every once in a while there would be a Shavar Brachas or something. And then I went to another yeshiva, and in that yeshiva, they had the custom that when one of the older boys got engaged, the night he came back, they would dance for him after Marav. All the boys would get together and dance. And so I got roped into playing that fairly frequently. And at some point during the year, one of those guys says to me, my parents are making Shavar Brachas for me, you know, after the wedding, and it's during Bein Hazmanim, so you're off. Would you like to play? Well, I'll hire you. And
was that your first paid gig?
That was my first paid gig. And I made $75. and that's really how it started. And then I switched yeshivas. The next year, there was a guy in the yeshiva whose brother was having a bar mitzvah. And he asked me if I would do his brother's bar mitzvah together with the drummer in the yeshiva. And things kind of spiraled out of there. I started studying privately again with different teachers. And I started getting calls while I was in college to play weddings and parties. And things kind of really evolved out of that in terms of getting involved in playing weddings. And what I discovered when I was playing weddings, I crossed paths with a lot of different kinds of musicians. And there were basically two major groups of musicians that you see at weddings. One are the people who it's a job, it's a time clock. They come, they do their job, they go home. And I would put a lot of the musicians who were conservatory trained in Russia and then moved over here to and earn a living playing weddings, a lot of them fell into that boat. And I'm sure in their personal lives, they had other musical interests, but on the bandstand, they flawlessly executed whatever needed to get done, but they never stepped away in any creative way from whatever needed to get done. Meaning right. that if something creative was given to them on sheet music or inspiring, they played it really well. But they never took a tune and said, hey, what happens if we experiment with it or play a non-traditional groove or something different. The other kind of wing of musicians, there are a lot less of these, were people who had their head very much in improvisational music and in artistic endeavors and creating either original music or interpreting other kinds of music, whether it was jazz or klezmer. And some of those musicians were very influential on me in the sense that I liked their approach. And I also got invited to come hear them. And I wound up as a relatively, you know, in my late teens in places like the Knitting Factory in New York with an avant-garde radical Jewish culture scene and jazz scene and being exposed to a lot more creative or interesting kinds of music rather than the more pop or commercial approach that you might have seen at a wedding. And also they had ironically, they had a much healthier perspective on the older Jewish music compared to the jobbers. The jobbers were, that's old and now we're going to play the stuff that's popular right now. And when that's not popular, we're not going to play that either and we'll play something else. And these people loved all of it, wanted to find the parts of it that spoke to them and play that and do something with that. And for me, that really resonated a lot. And it was a huge influence on starting the Breslov Bar Band, actually, because I was looking for to have a creative project where I could take Jewish music and it wasn't dictated by people need to dance to this for 35 minutes now at this tempo. I could take a song and I could say, you know, it's a fast song, but I feel like playing it slower, or it's a slow song and I feel like I could put all these different harmonies on it. And even though they're not traditional, it will be interesting, or we could do it with a reggae groove or whatever it was. And so that's really what kind of fueled the idea behind the Breslov Bar Band, which is we take older Hasidic Nigunim mostly. Each album has one newer tune and the rest are old songs. Some of them are very old songs. And it's funk and it's rock and it's punk and it's reggae, but it's very Jewish and it has deep roots in Jewish music and Hasidish Nigunim, which is something that is important to me.
All right, so you went through a whole litany of things there. I want to touch on all of them. First thing I really want to hit on is you are the second person that I've had on very recently that have told me about their interest in playing trumpet and drums. Is that a common combination?
I don't think specifically. For me, it was an either or.
Okay.
I just was interested in those instruments. The irony is that I'm not a huge trumpet fan now.
No. Well, that's going to be difficult when we're talking about klezmer, but we'll get there.
It's very low on my, when I'm hiring musicians to fill out a band.
Interesting.
Trumpet is very low on the list of instruments that I would like to put on. There are specific trumpet players that I love to work with and I would love any opportunity to be on the bandstand with. But when I'm thinking about just a four-piece band, I'm not going to put a trumpet on it. If people need a horn section and they want two horns, I'd rather see a sax and a trombone than a trumpet, just in terms of the sound that I hear in my head. Right. Obviously.
I was just curious about that. I don't know if you're familiar with Michael Cohn, but we had him on. He's a baltokea and a trumpet and a drummer. And his son, Baruch, is a trumpet player and a drummer. So I just thought it was like an interesting combination that you mentioned. Those are the first two instruments that came out of your mouth when we were discussing this. But I'll leave it there. But when we're talking about Jewish music in general, so everything you mentioned between klezmer and current modern Jewish pop and Hasidic music, how should we think about defining Jewish music? What are the key areas of identifying a Jewish song?
Okay, well, two things. One is I don't feel like I should tell people how they should define Jewish music. So I wouldn't say that I want to define this for everybody. People okay. define things different ways and find meaning in different things. And something that sounds very crass or trite in terms of Jewish, some of the Jewish pop music today, there are people who connect to that very much. And for them, they see that as their Jewish expression. For me personally, I would kind of define Jewish music the following way. I would say Jewish music is music made by Jews as Jews. So, you know, somebody writing a Christmas song, not necessarily Jewish music, even though many of the famous ones were written by Jews, but somebody writing a song that they feel powerfully expresses their Judaism and they're intending to, whether I connect with it or not, I would consider that to be Jewish music. I guess you could also, in some sense, argue that Jewish music is whatever the Jews in a given community say it is.
Right.
So there is
so that. Certain communities might identify certain songs as Jewish and others not so much. But I guess when you're talking about like a differentiation, you can always, if that's your definition of a Jewish person composing a song for Jewish consumption, how do you
not talk? Specifically for Jewish consumption, just okay. as a Jew, he's trying to express a Jewish sentiment.
Oh, okay, fine.
Just for Jews.
I apologize. You're right. As a Jew, what would you do about songs that were necessarily might have been composed for other reasons and then adopted over to the Jewish world? Songs that were kind of, I guess, converted into Jewish songs. We can go through a list of all of those songs. I'm sure.
Right. There's a lot of those.
Yeah.
I don't have an issue with those in the abstract. I have an issue with the lack of honesty that some people have when they borrow songs. It's less of a problem nowadays with the internet, but pre-internet and pre-YouTube and the ability to just share the evidence of that something was lifted, there were a lot of Hasidic singers and composers who would lift material and share it as though it was original or in a misleading way, rather than saying, hey, we just took this German pop tune from Eurovision and put Yiddish words to it. We lifted the whole arrangement, we lifted the melody, we lifted everything, and here it is. And I think if they would have been honest about what it was, there would have been a lot of flack at the time.
Right.
And as the community became aware of it, there was, you know, some flack at some points from some people, but it wasn't the same.
Right.
And there's a lot of that sort of thing happening. I think people need to be upfront. If they borrow a tune, you know, B'Shem Omro, say where it is, say what it comes from, and let people make an educated decision about whether this is something that they feel for spiritual reasons or whatever they don't want to have at their party or they don't want to be involved with, or that they do and embrace it. I once had a very interesting interaction with a band leader down in the Philadelphia area. He leads like one of these American Jewish bands. They play a Horoset and they play a klezmer tune or two, kind of the way the American bands do, not necessarily the way people who really studied klezmer music and try to play it authentically do. Some of the musicians in that group have studied it somewhat, many have not and are just sort of winging their way through it. And he knew that I had taught at Klez camp and I taught klezmer and Hasidic music. And so he came over during the American part while the singer was singing, I think it was Staying Alive or something like this. And he said, this is klezmer, because klezmer music is really music that Jewish people perform and sing at their simchas. And he says, and we play a ton of Jewish weddings and this is what we play. And the same way the tunes from the 1800s, those were popular dance tunes. This is a popular dance tune, and so it's klezmer. And he was half kidding, but there was a little bit of that idea that, you know, Jewish community has embraced always influences, if not specific melodies from the cultures around them, and pretending that doesn't happen is kind of not really honest. The question right. is just, is it a tune or is it an influence? Is it something that has something that potentially could be questionable? Like there are some responsa addressing the issue of taking, in the Sephardic world, they would take romances. They would take these songs and they would use the melodies for davening. And Rav Avadya Yosef has a tshuva about this, where he addresses that and he mentions many gedolim who took such things. And he himself was famous for listening to some famous Egyptian female singer, at least one, maybe more. And so it's more complicated, but maybe some people would say that material, if it's a romance, it's inappropriate because of what it leads to in your mind, and you're supposed to be davening. But in general, the crossover between secular and Jewish is very reflective of whatever community you live in some right. form or another.
So you mentioned earlier about the point where, I guess, probably right in the early stages of the internet, when a lot of people started discovering that some of the songs they kind of grew up with weren't necessarily original. I'll use the term lifted, but maybe just the arrangements were taken and the melody, and maybe altered slightly, but it's definitely, you could hear it. I want to say in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, there was a kind of this uproar and everybody just trying to discover more of these things. But then I think we kind of went a little bit too far. And there was a story back then, probably about 15 years ago, with a popular Jewish singer whose name I will not mention, who sang, who had been recorded singing, I think, You Raise Me Up. The song You Raise Me Up was made popular by Josh Groban. And then people were all up in arms because, oh, he copped, like everybody was trying to find the time. But it happened, it turned out that a special needs child requested it, so he sang it. So there is that line where it's like, oh, is this a copy or is this a cover? So I do think that we do have to draw some sort of a line as to when we're talking about these types of things.
Right, well, I think context matters. I think, you know, you have groups like Schlock Rock, which they were very clear about what they were doing.
Right.
They took secular material, they wrote Jewish lyrics, they proudly shared that that's what they were doing. And part of the fun of that band was, you know, seeing how they took something and what they did with it, you know, how they turned Barbara Ann into Barbanelle or whatever.
Right.
Gershon Viroba did the same type of thing with variations. Harold Fruchter sang on the first one also. And there's nothing wrong with doing something like that, obviously. The issue is more one of context. If I have an album with 10 songs and 9 of them are original Hasidic compositions or Hasidic pop compositions, and the 10th one is one from Eurovision, and I put on the front of the album songs composed by Yossi Green, and I don't list individual composers for each track, and I don't tell people that it's, you know, that's a question, because whether a person agrees or not, different communities have different sensibilities. And I think as a performer, I always have to be sensitive to those, you know, to those communities. When I'm playing for Satmar, I wouldn't go in and play Hava Nagila. And when I'm playing for, you know, a modern Orthodox crowd, I wouldn't play the Nturikarta anthem. It hasn't come up to play the Nturikarta anthem at any gig, by the way. Although I do have a transcription of it. But
I think a lot of my listeners are now learning that there is a Nturikarta anthem. I did not know that. That exists?
It exists, and I'm probably the only musician I know of who has a transcription of it because I put it out. But just, you know, for the fun of it. But sensitivity to different audiences means that you have to know your audience. I always tell people that, you know, the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, starts out with Dalef Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Samid, and right over there the comment on is Dalef Nemiato Omed. And so I say it's the first rule of public speaking or public performing is to Dalef Nemiato Omed, know your audience.
Right.
You know, you have to know. As a band leader, you really have to know this. You see the crowd and you say, okay, this crowd I'm going to play this sort of music for and it's appropriate, or this crowd will not appreciate this sort of music and I shouldn't play it for them. And it's true both about secular versus Jewish and specific Jewish music, whether it's because it's one Hasidic group, it's one Hasidic group, and they don't get along with another one, right, and you don't want to play that thing, or whether it's their anti-Zionist or pro-Zionist or whatever, you want to play material that's appropriate for the specific simcha.
All right, I'm well aware that what I'm about to ask you could probably be like an entire lecture series, but if we can narrow it down to only a few minutes, or maybe we'll see how long we can go with this. But I'd like to get a little bit of a sense of the history of Jewish music. If we could talk a little bit about klezmer versus modern Jewish pop, and we could talk about Yiddish music versus Orthodox music. Like, how did we get, I guess, to where we are now? I feel like we have to start pretty far back. And this is going to be this could be a long conversation, but if you'd be so kind to make it.
I don't know about that. I think Jews just made music the same. I think it's a human nature to make music. And so Jews historically have made music. Like I said, it historically reflects the sounds of the cultures around them, wherever they live. That's why the Sephardic Jews songs sound Sephardic and the Ashkenazi Jews songs sound Ashkenazic. That's why Jews whose families came from Poland or Germany sound Eastern European. And if their family came from Turkey or Azerbaijan or whatever, it sounds more Mediterranean, Middle Eastern. And I think that's true throughout. I think the evolution from klezmer to Karl Bach to Hasidic pop is just reflective of what happened in the world at large. Hmm. When you had more folk singing and singer-songwriter and stepping away from the sort of Eastern European music. So the Jews who transplanted over, you know, after the jazz sort of, or during the jazz period. So they weren't, you could sing standards, but you're not really going to sing bebop. So they're creating songs in the, you know, to blend in with Peter, Paul and Mary and what have you from that time period, and just doing it in a Jewish way. Hmm. And so when they're creating, you know, rap now or Hasidic rap or Hasidic EDM, it's the stuff you hear when you walk down the street and that car stops at the traffic light with the windows open and the big subwoofers. So even if you're not listening to secular music, you hear it. And the music translates into the rhythm of how people speak and how people move, translates into its rhythmic phrases that are translated into music. I actually once took an interesting class with a well-known klezmer clarinetist, Dave Krakauer, who had a very, very high profile classical career, and he kind of diverted into also performing, or primarily even performing klezmer. And someone asked him, how come you did that? And he said, well, we grew up not doing much Jewish, but klezmer music, which I didn't listen to as a child, has the rhythmic inflections, the rhythms are the way my grandmother spoke. He claimed that he heard her speech patterns in the the ornamentation and the phrasing of klezmer melodies. And that's what drew him to that music. And so I think the culture you're in creates a certain element of the music that you listen to. And obviously you use other influences as well. And so Hasidim who have some exposure to klezmer or more really Hasidic nigunim that are rooted in the same scales as the klezmer scales are going to create pop music with some of those scales or melodies that move similarly, but over more contemporary to them, you know, more contemporary rhythms.
So I'm going to ask you a similar question to what I asked you before. How do you, instead of we, let's make it you this time, how do you delineate between what you're hearing, if that's Hasidic music or if that's klezmer music or if that's modern Jewish pop or if that's something else? How do you know? Is it based on the rhythm? Is it based on the instruments that are used?
I hear influences. I don't like buttonholing things into this is klezmer or this is, you know, Hasidic. Obviously, if you hear a band recording from the 1800s with a hammered dulcimer, which klezmer musicians would call a cymbal, and a couple of violins and maybe a clarinet, that's, you know, Eastern European klezmer or some variation there, usually Eastern European, but something like that. But if I've got a DJ and he's using samples of cantors and a clarinet playing over that, so I'll say I hear cantorial influences and klezmer influences. Is clearly Jewish music, but I wouldn't try and say it is klezmer, and I wouldn't try and say it's absolutely not. It's one way that a contemporary musician might approach klezmer or might approach this material.
Okay, so I want to shift a little bit and talk about probably the areas of Jewish music that my audience is probably most familiar with, and that is more modern Ashkenazi pop, Hasidic pop music. From what I've been able to kind of box in, I know you don't like putting people in boxes and music in boxes, but I'm going to do it because I like doing that. Okay. So today's modern music, basically, in my opinion, had two major influences back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And that was, you're either talking about somebody coming from the track of Mordechai Ben David, or you're someone coming from the track of Shlomo Carlebach. And basically, those two kind of influenced current modern music in almost exclusively between those two. There might be a little bit if you want to throw Yussel Rosenblatt, that's a lot earlier. But of those two kind of had their direct influence on what we do today. And there's some definite clear tracks as to which ways those diverged. And I was wondering if you thought that I am making this up out of whole cloth, or if there's some truth to that, or if you have a different way of looking at it.
Well, I would break that down differently. I would say I would distinguish between singer-songwriters and commercial musicians.
Okay.
The commercial musician is trying to make a hit. He may, or she for that matter, but in the Orthodox world, until recently, it was largely only men, although now there are quite a few women who perform for women only. But they were trying to get a big hit. They're focused on sales, concerts, and if something is not the most appealing song or the most inspiring song, but they think people will go for it, they'll sell it because it's a business and they're trying to have the hit. Obviously, it's a generalization, but in general, that's how I see those guys. The singer-songwriters more often are trying to express themselves, and maybe they're trying to make a living at it also, but the stuff they're writing is generally tends to be original and tends to be a form of self-expression. They're a lot less likely to lift material from elsewhere compared to the sort of commercial singers. Mm. Like, for example, Mordechai Ben David recorded versions of a lot more secular tunes than Shlomo Carlbach did, although Shlomo Carlbach, you know, would perform folk songs at various folk festivals, but he didn't present them as his. The context was, we're going to sing Kumbaya or whatever it is that, you know, spiritual or whatever it is, because we're having this moment together. Mordechai Ben David, he covered a bunch of unusual songs, shall we say, that weren't Jewish over the years. Andrew Lloyd Webber, he did Close Every Door to Me from Joseph as Lichtiger Shabbos.
Right.
He took Germany's 1979 Eurovision entry, Genghis Khan, a song about Genghis Khan, and turned that into Kum Taheim, Yidden,
right,
which became a popular line dance a few years after he released it. Bobby Vinton's Melody of Love. There's a tune that was popularized by Cab Calloway that he did as Daddy Dear.
While we're on this topic, because this is the one that I know a lot of people love, are there any songs out there that you want to out right now as having been sampled, let's say, and used in a Jewish sense that people might not be aware of? I have my personal favorite, which I will... My personal favorite is Yehuda's Hu Macha.
Okay, Christa Berg.
Which is Christa Berg's Nose of New York. That was my personal favorite.
Right. I think probably the most fascinating one to me is one that I believe was done not deliberately, subconsciously, and it's not from the Hasidic music world. It's Naomi Shemer's Jerusalem of Gold.
What? You're going to ruin a lot of people right now.
Naomi Shemer composed the chorus, the classic chorus, Yerushalayim
Shel Zahav,
that part, that's original. But the beginning parts of the tune are stunningly similar to a Basque folk melody. And I'm going to profoundly mispronounce the name. It's something like Peyo Yosepi or something. It's spelled, I think, P-E-L-L-O. And the second word is J-O-X-E-P-E.
Oh, my goodness.
And I actually have a copy of the recording that a Basque musician sent me at some point. The Basque were struggling for independence. And Naomi Shemer actually went to hear Paco Ibanez perform. And she heard the singer perform this song. And I believe subconsciously it's stuck in her head. It's remarkably, remarkably similar. If you look it up, you'll
definitely gonna look it up. And then
slightly different meter. It's 6/8 instead of 3/4, and there's a little melodic change, but it's basically the same melody as the verses of Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. And over the years, people said to her that it sounds remarkably like this song. And she always, but before she passed away, she wrote a letter to, I think it was Gil Almador, but to one of the Israeli arrangers, saying that she had gone to hear Paco Ibanez perform, and apparently the melody stuck in her head subconsciously, and she thought she'd written something, but it clearly, you know, she definitely heard that singer sing that melody, and then she wrote Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. But she also has a track record of having written a huge body of material,
right,
that is melodically and lyrically creative. So it's not like she's a songwriter who took three word quotes from Tanakh or whatever, Shabbos Miris, and turned that into material, and then all of a sudden also did this. To my mind, it has the ring of truth that she probably heard it. And if you could imagine the state of Israel struggling for independence at that point, and connecting to the another culture that's doing the same thing, and being hearing a folk singer sing that song, I imagine that it would have been a powerful experience, and she may not have realized that she memorized the tune.
Right. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of those. Somebody once pointed out to me the there's a Mendi Wald song that was composed by Yossi Green, Al Tomar Lechashevna Eshne, which sounds like boom, 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 let me hear you say wayo. And I'm like, oh, that if you listen to the rest of both of those songs, they don't really, it's just like this one simple, like one section, small section, that in my mind, there's a finite amount of musical notes. I mean, it's vast, but it is a finite, and every once in a while you might get a something that sounds similar.
I think phrases can cross over, and I think that can be unconscious or conscious. You know, there's no way to know without talking to the person who did it. But I tend to assume that people didn't do something deliberately when it's something minor like that, unless I have reason to think that they did. But
I want to give you a chance to plug both your band, the Breslov Bar Band, and your book. So I'll let you choose which one is. So, you know what? I'm going to choose. I'm the host. I'm going to choose. talk to me about the Breslov Bar Band. You guys perform at concerts? Do you guys perform weddings? Do you do both? Where can we find your music? Where can we hear you live?
Okay. It's COVID still. Things are hopefully winding down. But for right now, we have no performances currently booked. We're imminently going to be releasing our third album. It's being mastered a little bit later this month. And then we will release that. In the meantime, we have two albums out. First album is called Have No Fear. And the second album is called Happy Hour. And you can find those at all the usual online, iTunes, Spotify, what have you, digital distribution places.
If you were to describe the style of music, that would be like for our listeners, if they're going to want to tell them why they should be interested in it.
Sure. So the band is today's musicians living in today's world, using their musical vocabulary to explore older Hasidic nigunim. And it's something, it's basically my personal and the band collectively's creative interpretation or reimagining of these songs. So it's very strongly rooted in Hasidic music, klezmer, however you define that, but it's reggae and it's funk and it's punk rock, and it's all sorts of different genres of music organically blended in ways that suit the raw material. So I'll take a nigun that speaks to me and I'll write an arrangement that I feel expresses the essence of the melody, but I'm going to use musical language that somebody 200 years ago in Eastern Europe would not have dreamed of using. And the instrumentation, it's basically a rock band in terms of the rhythm section. So drums, bass, electric guitar, I play vintage keyboards. So electric pianos of various sorts, Rhodes, Wurlitzer, organ. And the front line is, I also play melodicas, which are mouth-blown keyboards, and a clarinet and a baritone saxophone. So we have a three-reed front line at times, and a rock plus a very versatile rock style rhythm section.
All right, so the question is going to be then, where did the name Breslov Bar Band come from?
So the name came from, I was looking for something fun that would immediately convey what we're trying to do. And the idea was that we didn't want to get up, we wanted to have fun. And kind of in a bar band, things are a little bit looser in terms of the arrangements, in terms of improvisation. It's about the moment and the audience and the band having a good time. And so I kind of wanted to convey that we're a fun party band, and we have played in bars, and we'll play anywhere that people would like to have us. We've played everywhere from weddings, bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, installation of a new rabbi at a synagogue, to concerts, and obviously bars. We're happy to do, basically my goal is to create a powerful Jewish music moment. And then the listeners can do with that whatever they do with that. We've had some very interesting reactions at shows from people who weren't Jewish, or from people who had not been very involved with anything Jewish music related, who felt very connected to what we did for some reason or another. I had one older gentleman come over to us after one performance. He said, "I know I've never heard you guys before, but I feel like I've heard this music and I know it. And I've been crying for the last hour while I'm listening to you." And I talked to him for a few minutes, and turns out that he grew up in Brownsville in the Bronx. And as we were talking, he said, "You know what it is?" He says, "We used to play stickball in the street on Saturday, and there was a Hasidic synagogue right there." And he says, "What you played, it brought me back to my childhood. It reminded me of the sounds that I heard playing stickball on the street in Brownsville, you know, all those many years ago." And so people connect to Jewish music differently, but my goal is to just create a meaningful Jewish music experience, whether it's live at a simcha where people are engaged in dancing and celebrating either chatan and kala, bride and groom, or bar bat mitzvah, or whether it's just a fun party and people want to have some sort of Jewish expression.
Right.
Happy to do it.
Now, it's COVID right now, and I'm assuming that once things get back a little bit closer to normal, you'll be able to perform live in different areas. And where can people find those dates out?
So people can find the band at breslovbarband.com.
Okay. Are you also on social media?
Unimaginative URL that just tells you the band.
It's surprising that wasn't taken already.
also easy to remember. So yeah. There is that. We have a forthcoming album release, God willing, sometime later this fall. I'll have more information about that in the near future.
Are you or the band on social media also?
I am. People can find me on Facebook. The band is not really so active. We have a Facebook page that Facebook decided to throttle unless you start. I made the mistake of paying for advertising, which was a mistake, because once I paid for advertising, then they throttled us after that way down because they want us to pay for more. And so I basically, you can find me on social media, and I share stuff about the band and my creative projects and what I'm doing. And the band has a website.
All right. And what about your book?
Oh, okay. Sure.
Not going to let you off without it.
So I self-published this book, and people can reach out to me directly to get it. I'm pretty easy to find. You can find me through jewishmusician.com. I can also give you my email address, which is binyamin@gmail.com.
It's it's amazing that you got that. Binyamin with an O, right?
Yeah, B-I-N-Y-O-M-I-N, binyamin@gmail.com. And it's a great email address, except that very from people who don't have email and need to leave an email address sometimes, if their name is Binyamin, happen to use it also. So particularly during Ben Asmanim, it ramps up, and I get these weird emails, like some yeshiva kid, you know, goes go-karting and needs to put an email in, and then he takes first place, and I get an email with his picture saying Binyamin, whatever it is, came in first at you know, Putnam Valley or whatever it is, go-karting. Amazing. I also get a phone bill for one person in Israel and an electric bill from a different person in Israel, who both gave my email address because their first name is Binyamin, and I guess they needed to put something in, so they thought Binyamin at Gmail, why not? So I published this book, and it's a documentation of the nigunim that are used at the Hasidic dance ritual called the mitzvah dance, which is an unusual Hasidic custom that's performed at weddings. Usually at the most Hasidic groups do this. Well, all of them, except Chabad, I believe, do it. But most of them do the entire thing at the end of a wedding. Some of them have a variation where the chassan does something the night before, but various dignitaries and family members, men, are called up to dance with or in front of really the bride. And there are different customs about it. There are different minhagim. Do they hold a gartel while they're dancing, or do they just dance in front of her? Is there a mechitza? Is she veiled or not? And all sorts of stuff. And I wrote an extensive essay talking about this minhag, why they do it, what Hasidim believe about what's happening at this moment in the wedding, different minhagim, different customs and ideas behind it and so forth. And so I wrote a big overview essay of what this is, and I transcribed 159 tunes for the book. And I tried to give a cross-section of songs that would be used at mitzvah tants, including the most popular ones that you're most likely to come across, songs that might be unique to mitzvah tants within specific Hasidic groups, and songs that might be a little more unusual or off the beaten track that might have been composed for a specific simcha or were popular at a specific point in time. And so a Rebbe chose to use it at that point, even though he wouldn't necessarily use it every single time. And I've been very fortunate. The response to the book has been very positive. I self-published it and I'm distributing it myself. And I've had inquiries and sold copies. It's gone as far as Japan.
Oh, wow.
So I had people in Japan and Germany and in the UK and in 20 something states around the United States and Israel purchase the book. And I've been very gratified by the response. And for people who are interested either in a collection of Hasidic music or in learning more about this ritual and the music behind it, it's a very good resource. And I'm happy to answer questions about the book also. People can reach out to me about that.
Phenomenal. Yeah, that could be a whole other podcast on its own. If you could send a picture of the book, we'll post it on our social media so people can judge your book by its cover. Sure. Whenever I have any musicians on here, I have a few quick questions to ask them. So if you indulge me, I'd appreciate it if that's okay.
Sure.
All right. First question, what song or album, maybe I prefer song, but what song has been overlooked by the Frum community that you think should get more fanfare?
Song overlooked by the Frum community. I don't have a specific song that I think has been overlooked. I think when you define Frum community, you need to narrow it down. I think each section of the Frum community has songs that they're overlooking. The most obvious one for me, coming as someone who performs a lot of Hasidic Nigunim, is I think the modern Orthodox community should look at more Hasidic Nigunim. I think there's a wealth of resources for them to look at in terms of exploring Jewish music that they may not be familiar with.
Do you want to one song to get them hooked?
It's not one song, it's everything.
Okay.
It's look at Chabad Nigunim and look at Mojitz Nigunim and look at Vishnitz Nigunim and look at Breslov Nigunim. There's a wealth of material, and there's a handful of songs that we hear over and over and over again at Simchas, and it's way deeper than that. But I would say the same thing goes with other communities also. There's a huge growing even now a world of sort of the egalitarian end of the modern Orthodox world, conservative, I don't know if you call them conservative, even Hadar world, that's creating profoundly deep Jewish music. And I think the Orthodox community should be looking at some of that. I think Joey Weisenberg, for example, is creating unbelievably deep, very strongly rooted in Judaism, Jewish music. He ironically has a Hasidic background in a sense that he used to go to hear Rabbi Twersky in, I believe it was Milwaukee, as a child. And so he was exposed to Hasidic Nigunim a lot, but he's composing American Jewish Nigunim that are unique and are profoundly deep. And I think it would be worthwhile for people to hear the music coming out of that, out of that scene. I think every community has some people in it that are profoundly creative, deeply creative. And I think a lot of us don't know about the people in the other communities or the music on those other scenes. I'm one of those musicians who kind of crosses a lot of boundaries. And so I play with the klezmer musicians in New York, and I play with the Hasidic musicians in New York, and I play with the modern Orthodox musicians, and I play with some of these the performers who are doing Joey Weisenberg material, or Deborah Saxman, so the Hadar Ensemble, Rabbi Yosef Goldman, this sort of thing, their material also. And so I have a very much of a bigger picture, I think, of this than a lot of people within each community, but I think there's a lot that each of us can learn from other communities. And I haven't even touched on Sephardic versus Ashkenazic, which some of that, just the language sounds so foreign, musically speaking, different scales, different notes even, with quarter tones and so forth. But I think more is better in terms of being open about exploring different ranges of Jewish music.
All right. Where do you prefer to perform, simchas or concerts?
I love both.
That's the easy answer.
Well, I was going to explicate. At a concert, I feel like I can perform generally what I'm motivated to perform in a way that I'm motivated to do it. I don't have the constraints that I have at a simcha. At a simcha, when the chatan and kala, when the chas and kala come into the room, so that kala's mother and probably the kala as well have been dreaming of dancing to Odi Shama for however old that kala is. No matter her age, that's been a dream. And it's my job to provide that, even if I've played Odi Shama already for the Badekin and after the chuppah, and I need to make sure that that happens. And for some people, they don't care what the song is, but for a lot of them, the image that they had in their head was that melody. And so I'm constrained, in a certain sense, by a responsibility to give the people who hired me the moments that they need. The dancing in the room based on the people needs to be a certain tempo. It needs to be, and obviously at a concert, you're also reading the crowd, but the requirements are different. I don't have a caterer telling me I'm bringing out the main in 30 minutes, so I need you to give me 30 minute dance set. And I've had that happen at weddings where we didn't put the food in the oven yet, so now I need an hour long dance set. And it's like, well, they're older people and there aren't so many of them. I don't know that I can give you an hour dance set. I'll try, but I don't have that. And usually we succeed, but I don't have those constraints at a concert.
Right.
On the flip side, at a wedding, especially when I do it with my own band, it's something personal for me. The wedding that we met at, for example, the Chatan and Kala had quite a few unusual, shall we say, music requests, particularly for the ceremony. And one of the things that was fascinating to me was actually learning about what they liked and then being able to deliver that. They actually like Eurovision. And there's a subgenre, which I was not aware of solo piano slowed down versions of Eurovision hits. So there's fast Eurovision pop tunes, and you can find solo, slow, pensive piano arrangement, instrumental arrangements of them on YouTube. And they chose to walk down to two of those tunes from this year's Eurovision. So there, to the best that I could determine searching online, there is no published transcription for the tune the bride walked down to. And I transcribed it myself. And I actually posted a clip of it on my Facebook page at some point because I thought it came out really nicely. We played it with clarinet and keyboard. So for me, it was very meaningful to be able to give them what they wanted. They sent me a very eclectic list of chuppah music. And I, instead of, some bands would say, well, this is not what we usually do, pick from this list. And I said, it's not
challenge accepted.
We'll do all of it. And we did. So we played Concerning Hobbits from Lord of the Ring, and we played some Eurovision tunes, and we played Uncle Moishe's Pizza Song, you know, because that's what would make the party meaningful for them. And it felt good to be able to do that for them. And it felt good. I felt like I was a part of the simcha.
That's awesome. Last question. If you can collaborate, you or your band can collaborate with any other musician, who would you pick?
Oh, wow. If I could collaborate with any musician and my band right now.
Either you by yourself or you and your band with someone else.
If I could collaborate with the band right now, I would want to collaborate with one of the Breslov composers, like Yosef Parduner.
Probably interesting.
He's the one I would pick with the Breslov bar band, because I love what he does. I love his songwriting. And I think it would be interesting to take if he would be open for it, to have a little bit of a more free arrangement approach to his music compared to the sort of approach he has, which is, I'm not going to say it's formulaic, but it sounds like him always. He does right. The same sorts of things.
Interesting. That's a good choice. I have not heard that name, Yosef Kaduner, in a while. He was really big when I was in high school.
He's still out there. He's still performing.
He's still doing stuff.
He's still writing new songs. And amazing. I had the honor of playing with him last year, actually, during the pandemic, he came and performed at a local yeshiva, and I played melodica with him. So it was just the two of us.
That's amazing.
And I've actually been very into playing melodica. I created a voice for Jewish music on that instrument. And I've played with a bunch of popular Jewish singers the last few years on that instrument. And it was just the two of us, and it was a lot of fun. And we had a very strong musical connection from the first note. It felt very in sync. And he felt it too. He told me as much afterwards. So, I would love the opportunity to actually collaborate in more than an impromptu way.
Awesome. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with, Binyamin, before we let you go?
Not really. I always feel like, well, if there's something you want to leave us with, and I have to say something profound and deep and meaningful, but the truth is that I just, like, kind of like what I try to do with the album titles of our albums, is just, you know, give somebody a little idea that they could look into for themselves. So each of our albums has a meaningful title in Breslov thought specifically, and Hasidic thought, I guess, in general also, except for those who disagree with Breslov's approach. And so I guess I'll leave you with just the titles of the albums, which are, one is Have No Fear, which is fairly obvious, as Rabbi Nachman was famous for saying that the main thing is to have no fear. Kol Olam Kulo Gesher Tzar Ma'od. That's a statement of Rabbi Nachman. The entire world is a narrow bridge. The main thing is to have no fear. Another thing that he said was Mitzvah Gedola Lios B'Simcha Tamid. It's a great mitzvah to be constantly happy, which loosely translated means that every hour is happy hour.
Amazing. All right, Binyamin Ginsberg, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day.
Thank you for having me.
My thanks to Binyamin Ginsberg for joining us this week. My question for all of you is, what is your favorite Jewish song that has been lifted from others? Can you find the originals? Also, do you know of songs that sound like others but weren't necessarily lifted? We'll do our best to link to some of the ones we mentioned in this episode on our Twitter page. Until next time, Kol Tov.
The Jewish Living Podcast is produced by Sreli Pikus. Our theme song is The Band by A.B. Rottenberg. Follow us on Facebook at The Jewish Living Podcast and on Twitter and Instagram at Jewish_living. You can also email the show at jewishlivingpodcast@gmail.com. The Jewish Living Podcast is recorded in conjunction with the Queens Jewish Link.